The Bitcoin Group, the American original. For over the last 10 seconds, the sharpest Satoshis, the best Bitcoins, the hardest cryptocurrency talk. We'd like to welcome our panelists, Ben Ark from LN Bits.
Evening all.
Josh Shigala from thestandard.io.
Bing bong, blimey, blimey, bing bong.
Dan Eve, the Crypto Raptor.
Willkommen, ja.
And I'm Thomas Hunt from the World Crypto Network. Moving on to issue one, a closely watched Bitcoin metric is flashing a buy signal that has historically led to huge gains. According to Hash Ribbons, the price of Bitcoin may be going up. According to Charles Edwards, founder of quantitative crypto fund Capriole Investments, the idea of hash ribbons from 2019 identifies buying opportunities for Bitcoin. When the 30-day moving average for hash rate dips below the 60-day moving average, this is called a bearish cross and signals that miners are shutting down machines. Usually, selling is associated with these events. As more miners are taken out of the market, the difficulty of mining Bitcoin reduces because there's less competition. And this could be a good time to buy. Ben Ark, what do you think about hash ribbons?
Yeah, these trades are always looking for patterns, obviously, in their technical trading. And usually they're complete nonsense. But I do think there is some correlation between hash rate and the price, of course, because miners are people who are economically incentivized to make the most of their hash rate and their mining power. But then there are all these other factors which come into play when it comes to miners turning off their hash rate, such as, you know, wars, bans on mining in the sovereign country where they live, and all these other things. But there certainly is, you know, when you look at that chart, which was in the article, and there certainly does look like there is some sort of correlation. And what's interesting is the separation between hash rate and price, and how the swings in hash rate seem to get larger, obviously, as the price of Bitcoin goes up. But when you actually look at hash rate on the chart, there does seem to be like a steady, just, you know, increase of hash rate over time, which is you know, exciting, because it means that the network's becoming more secure. But yeah, I'm not sure, obviously, with if this particular metric makes sense, but I do think there's something there. There's something in hash rate and price, and maybe this is the sort of trading technical signal which people can use, but I'm not sure, quite sure it's there yet. People have always argued that hash rate for price follows hash rate, and this does kind of nod towards that. So it's an interesting metric, and I thought the chart was pretty interesting too.
Well, people love to argue that the price follows the hash rate because the hash rate always goes up. So that makes it easy. Josh Shigala, your thoughts on hash ribbons. Has Bitcoin reached its bottom?
I agree with Ben. There's always technical analysis, but I think when it comes to hash rates, it's more of a fundamental analysis game, because you can make a correlation definitely between these fundamental building blocks of Bitcoin, the things that actually keep this thing going. And like you said, Thomas, they're extremely incentivized. Or was it you, Ben? someone just said it. And that incentivization is purely price-based. Now, the only thing that happens is that certain miners have more capacity to hold or to hodl and to keep paying electricity until the price is back up. And I think this is the correlation, that the little miners tend to drop out, because it's like, basically the lower the price goes, the longer your hodl time has to be until you speculate that you can make money on what you're earning right now. And this has always been the case, even when Bitcoin was at $30. So I think there's a case to be had for this metric, and it's an interesting one. It's not as like cut and dry, because and it's also not very intuitive, because you think, well, if more miners sell, then there's more selling pressure as the price goes down. But right now, I think there's more to play than just Bitcoin. I dare say it, that Ethereum is also steering a little part of the crypto ship nowadays, not just because historically it's always just been Bitcoin, whatever Bitcoin does. And then Bitcoin was very independent of the wider stock market, pretty much, because it was its own thing. But nowadays, it's also quite correlated to the stock exchange, to the global economic sort of pulse. And now you have a little bit of a correlation with miners, but also with Ethereum. And Ethereum's just about to do this mega merge upgrade in early September. So I think that's also a strange one. Like, do people trust an upgrade on a plane that's already flying with billions of dollars locked in value in this thing? If they don't, they'll be selling. So there's more selling pressure. If they like it and they think, oh, maybe it's a hard fork, so I'll get, because there's obviously people that will want to continue the proof of work chain on Ethereum. And so there'll be a fork and people get double the coins, and because, you know, that's how these hard forks work. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see. It'll be interesting to see what happens. I really don't know how to calculate this one. I'm just sticking with the old HODL mentality of whatever happens, happens. I'm going to sit through it and go for it.
Well, I agree with Josh. I definitely think that analyzing the miners is more interesting than just technical analysis, just looking at the charts and saying, well, the chart did this, so that, because the miners really do have to sell if the price goes low enough. I just want to give a shout out to our 14 live viewers. We only have 2 likes out of 14, so still a chance for you guys to push the thumbs up button, YouTube algorithm being all that. And Josh also opened up the idea of the Ethereum merge. So Dan, Eve, what do you think about hash ribbons? Usually sounds like a good thing. And the Ethereum merge, normally not such a good thing, but we'll see how it turns out.
Well, and initially hash ribbons made me think of like some sort of edible that gets you high. But obviously there's a lot more to it than that. I think with the general technical analysis, I feel that, you know, it's kind of really easy to kind of just keep on pumping out patterns and then adjusting them. And then one of them hits and it's kind of that kind of, almost like the psychic with the reading the signs, and you remember the hits and forget the misses, right? But some of this, it's a bit more fundamental, as Josh said, that, you know, that it's actually based on metrics to do with hash rate, for example. It's something that's directly measurable that has an impact. Although since, I mean, this article came out in, just over a day ago, and since it came out, it does say flashing a huge buy signal with huge gains, but Bitcoin's dropped 4.2%. So unlucky if you followed the article straight away. But that doesn't mean the Bitcoin's going to keep on going down. Maybe these hash ribbons are correct. At the moment, the hash rate's 230, according to BitInfo charts, 237 exahashes, which is just a bit shy, actually, of 253, which is the all-time high. And the difficulty as well is still pretty high at the moment. But there's been news about Samsung are going to be making chips soon. And going back again on the general mining and, you know, good environment, bad environment impacts thing. So we always hear about Bitcoin being compared to you know, countries in terms of its usage. But recently read an article about TSMC, you know, the big chip fabrication company in Taiwan. and it was the first thing that I'd seen as a direct article about them being compared to, or that specific company, the fabrication company, chip manufacturing company, that using more electricity than entire countries with 20 million inhabitants. So it's not just Bitcoin that's taking the rap of like being compared to, you know, using more electricity than a country. But one thing that I did think about earlier is about how the halvening possibly, you know, the impact of halvening, it probably it gets less over time because of the, if you think about in 2012 there was 50 Bitcoin mined, which is per block, which is 7200 per day. And when it halved to 3,600 per day, the supply was about 10.5 million. So it went from about 0.068% of Bitcoin mined per day out of the total supply down to 0.034%. Now, at the current debt rate, the amount of Bitcoin mined per day compared to the total supply is 0.0047%, which is 1/14. So as the, you know, as the mining rewards drop, also the supply does get bigger. So you've got less of an impact of the halvening effect, where there's a lot less coins hitting the market in comparison to the total volume. But nevertheless, I'm still a believer that when we are, you know, we are mid halvening, it's going to be a bit of shaky ground. But when the next halvening comes up, there's all the usual hype that there is. And maybe not, you know, maybe not for this particular buy signal, but for certainly for a long term hold. One thing that is for sure is that Bitcoin's price does go up after halvenings, you know, albeit with a little bit of drag or trail after the halvening. But yeah, so maybe not hash ribbons, maybe just get high off them by the sounds of it. But the halvening, I look forward to.
For the next halvening, I predict hats, because we had hats at the last halvening. Thanks everybody for the 5 more likes. If you're watching at home later, you can always push that like button. That way the YouTube algorithm knows this is a good show. Ben Ark, Josh opened it up. What do you think about the Ethereum merge? Obviously it's a win-win for me. It means I get 2 copies of my NFTs, cha-ching. Of course, it comes with the usual cautions about multi-chain transactions. If you do access, for example, one of your NFTs on the Ethereum proof of stake chain, you might be exposing your key to the proof of work chain. So you might get attacked. Someone might steal your other NFTs. If you're really only playing on one chain, this doesn't matter. But if you're trying to be smart and fancy and sell your Ethereum proof of stake or sell your Ethereum proof of work, just like in the Bitcoin versus Bcash dilemma, there are 2 wallets with the same key.
When I read about the move to proof of stake, I thought you had to like burn your proof of work coins in order to access your proof of stake coins in Ethereum. Is that how it works? I mean, that's how it was originally intended to work. I suppose maybe now they've just switched to have both. I'm sure someone will come up with some clever little tool which allows you to, you know, like they did with the Bcash forks, where you can just quickly. Like,
yeah, I would definitely keep up with the forums and stuff. Try to read the expert advice. This is not expert advice here, but we're assuming if there's 2 chains, there's going to be these kind of problems.
Yeah, I think when I read the original thing, you had to like destroy or make redundant your proof of work coins in order to access proof of stake coins. But if it's changed, then there will be some tool out there to, you know, get both coins. Just be careful. Was it Trezor? I think there was some pretty big hardware wallets kind of made some easy tools for being able to benefit from the chain splitting into 2 different, you know.
I know for a while there you could contact Jimmy Song and get all the best service. He'd split your coins off.
So is the risk that the weaker secure chain will, if you transact on the weaker secure chain, then it will open you up to the getting hacked on the more secure chain?
I guess it's something like that. I remember being at a conference and Jimmy Song saying to me, does anyone know how to set up a BSV wallet? And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? And it was for that exact reason. He had like some big client with big fat bags who was trying to make the most of all these splits. So there's somebody.
And I imagine that same thing will happen now. If you have a CryptoPunk on the main chain, you'd have a CryptoPunk on the secondary chain. Like you're saying, Dan, if you try to separate them, you might be exposing your key for one of them. And then only move one, not both. So if you move both, i.e. get rid of that old wallet, you're probably fine. If you just move one, never interact with the other, you're probably fine as well. And there's not to say there's a big market for gray secondary market CryptoPunks. Then of course, if the Ethereum proof of work chain somehow beats the proof of stake chain, seems really unlikely, but that's the same argument that we had last time with Ethereum and Ethereum Classic. As I'm sure everyone recalls, after the DAO hack, when Ethereum rolled back their network and took the money away from the hacker, gave it back to the people who had given it to a bad smart contract and who lost money and made it so they instead had their money, there were 2 versions of Ethereum then, and there are still 2 versions of Ethereum now, but now there's going to be 3 it looks like.
So I'm assuming that the layer two is scarce and not reproducible. I thought that's the whole point. But there we are.
It's carbon copy.
Well, I mean, you know, Satoshi did put the hard fork in place, and it's a very interesting mechanism, because if you don't agree with the upgrade, you can hold the other fork and continue with that. And that's fantastic. There isn't twice as many. There's just two chains. They're different. And so, and to your point there, Ben, with burning one, I think that might be the case. I don't fully know it still, but there is talks of independent groups wanting to have split a full hard fork away. That's totally independent of the merge.
I suppose you shouldn't be forced to have to do that to burn your coins, should you? You should be able to access them on the original chain.
Yeah.
Rather than being forced.
Well, the main issue here is the Ethereum miners, right? If you have a bunch of rigs and you're mining proof of work Ethereum, and all of a sudden they say, no, we're not going to do that anymore, you have a reason now to promote the proof of work, to promote the old chain.
Yeah. I was on our Twitter spaces yesterday with Hartej Soni from Zookio Labs. He's one of the one of the people that really founded smart contract auditing. He mentioned there was a couple of people before him, but he was very early on, and one of his takeaways from yesterday's talk was that there are going to be a lot of scams around this fork, and so just be careful. Exactly what Ben said as well. Just be careful during these sorts of times. You'll get all sorts of weird messages saying this is the real Ethereum. You just have to send your Ethereum here, and it upgrades. And you know, it's just basically preying on people that don't know anything. And this is a very, very complex area of finance nowadays. You know, it's a whole fledgling industry that you generally need to do a lot of research. So there's a lot of normies out there that have just got their day jobs. They've got a couple of crypto punks or whatever, and now they're like, oh, what's this merge, splurge, verge, and purge thing? that's the Ethereum upgrades.
Like, I am sponsored this all over again.
Certainly, you must be a fan of the Ethereum merge. You get twice as many coins. Uncle Vitalik has doubled our coins by November, as promised.
Me no hold Ethereum, but it's interesting just to follow, right? Because there's obviously it's a big bone of contention with some people how the moving from, obviously, from proof of work, obviously, is as we see in Bitcoin is the strongest way of securing a network. So moving to proof of stake has its own vulnerabilities, but it's interesting to follow and just observe the fights from each of the communities. You know, you've got all the different sides. You've got Ethereum infighting over which one's best, and then you've got Bitcoin pointing out that obviously proof of work's best. So but I don't know, it'd be interesting to see how it works with there's so many interconnecting things, right, with the layer twos, like is Polygon, are things going to be smooth on those networks, and how that everything that like that interlinks, all the exchanges, the DEXs, which one do they naturally follow? I mean, I haven't really read a huge amount, but is it just going to be automatic that they pick the one that, I don't know, Vitalik wants, the proof of stake one? Is it all geared up for that, or could there be a possibility that it accidentally follows the wrong chain? I mean, I don't know. It's going to be an interesting thing to follow, but yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity for people for getting scammed, unfortunately. There'll be all sorts from panic emails going around, fake panic emails like quick save your coins now because there's an issue, and people will go to sort of my Ether wallet type clones or my crypto, whichever is called now, and upload their file or their private keys and into the hands of a hacker. So I think it's going to open up a lot of people for hacks, unfortunately, and probably a lot of general panic from people not knowing, from a technical perspective, how things are going to work, and that the safe route for them is just to go into a stable coin or go into Bitcoin.
Yeah, this is no one really knows. So if you look at Ethereum, the original value proposition of Ethereum, people being able to use gas fees to run these smart contracts, The way Ethereum works now is not the way it was intended to work. And there were some very, you know, technical papers which had had a lot of thought put into them. And then in the reality of running Ethereum, it just couldn't work the way they wanted it to work. And I kind of feel that with the proof of stake stuff, there's so much complexity that, you know, no one can predict how this thing is going to pan out and whether it'll end up working as they intended to work.
I think that's a very valid argument, Ben. But one of the arguments that I find a little bit weak is that proof of stake is centralizing. Because if we have a look at like the Bitcoin mining, like pie chart, like the mining pools, it's quite centralized. You know, you have like Foundry at 23.5%, Ant pool at 16%, F2 pool at 15%. It's kind of three pools and you're already over 51%, right? A proof of stake, yeah, you'll get some big players like Coinbase having a shit ton of coins, but there are a lot of exchanges nowadays. It's not like the old days where you have Mt. Gox and Coinbase or like Kraken and BTCe or something. But nowadays there's so many exchanges all around the world, and while I think there's some with more like Coinbase, I don't understand the logic. While I'm totally open to hearing it because it's a very important conversation to have, I don't understand fully how it can be more centralizing than three pools being over 51%.
And we could say, I mean, what I said before also applies to Bitcoin, because obviously the way in which mining was supposed to work, it was that's how the consensus was supposed to be found. And then with the Node2x and the SegWit stuff, we saw that it was the users who in fact sort of wielded the power by the node software in which they would run. So I think with the proof of stake stuff, it's just whether the users will ultimately have last say on decision making or whether it will just be the majority stakeholders. And I think in Bitcoin with proof of work, we've kind of proved that the users are the ones who ultimately have the last say. Whereas in a very complicated consensus mechanism, which includes all sorts of social stuff and everything else, but whether that will carry over to proof of stake, I'm not sure.
So that's what I think they'd like to see. They'd like to see that power taken away from the users and given to the developers and to the powerful holders. So in that way, proof of stake might work very well for them.
But also, you know, so Bitcoin Gold, that got 51% attacked, and Verge 51% attacked, right? Have there been any examples yet of 51% attacked proof of stake coins?
I couldn't tell you. I think the entire system
is a 51% attack. I mean, all the players in proof of stake are attacking it. But I mean, more importantly, now that they've admitted that this isn't going to make the fees go down, this isn't a fee solution, why are they even doing it? It seems like they're doing it mainly as an environmental response to Bitcoin, so that they can say, we have environmentally proof of stake, you have environmentally dirty proof of work. What do you guys think about this? Is this just about long-term mining, computational, like that's all they're doing? It's that kind of upgrade?
I think it's a brilliant argument, and it will sway a lot of people. That's the thing which worries me actually about its impact on Bitcoin, is how they can kind of wave that flag that they're not consuming all this carbon in the same way that Bitcoin is producing, yeah. Not consuming. If it was consuming, that'd be good. But maybe
it's a giant marketing stick to wave at Bitcoin, and they're going to get on high horses. That's definitely going to happen. Yeah,
but
they'll get on high horses with their hash ribbons. Go ahead, John.
It doesn't matter. Like, miners will keep on mining. They don't care. They care about profit. They care about how much money they're making. And so it doesn't really matter what flag they wave, environmental or not. People will choose the chain that's useful to them in terms of users. And I got to say, functions like decentralized finance, where you can borrow and do all this stuff with smart contracts, where you hold the keys, is very, very alluring for me personally. And I know that you can do that on Bitcoin using sidechains, but it's not on chain. I would like to see stuff happening on layer two on Bitcoin. But yeah, I mean, I think that's more of the case, like real use cases. What makes it useful? You can go to town and all the media can go on about how much environmentally friendly it is. But at the end of the day, it's about cost of transactions, and Lightning Network is pretty much free. And it's also utility, right?
Well, get ready for the environmental attack. Moving on to issue two. Issue two, more than half of all Bitcoin trades are fake. Wash trading, it's not just for altcoins anymore. A new report shows that more than half of all Bitcoin trades are fake. Josh Shigala, is Bitcoin a fake market because there are so many fake trades?
Well, that, I mean, duh. You just need to look at CoinMarketCap and look at some of the ridiculous volume that some no-name exchanges got. Some two-bit exchange pops up out of nowhere and has, you know, $16 billion worth of volume. No, they don't. It doesn't take half a brain to figure that out. So it's funny that these articles come out like they're some sort of like really.
So Josh, what does wash trading mean? How is wash trading possible on these new exchanges, but not possible on, say, Coinbase?
It is possible on Coinbase. It's possible on any exchange. We've never done it, and that's why you can see real volume, which is pretty low compared to like some of these other exchanges. What wash trading is basically the exchange has got an order book, and they'll just buy and sell their own coins over and over again, bringing up the volume chart and go, look how much volume we're trading. And they're just trading it themselves, the exchanges. Or they're paying market makers to trade it with themselves constantly. There is a legitimate reason for wash trading, and that is it's not really wash trading. It's basically when the market maker has a position too high on one side and they need to rebalance themselves. And so they'll trade between market makers to sort of rebalance. But that's not really wash trading. What's wash trading really in the pure sense is an exchange basically taking, you know, 100 Bitcoin and or less, one Bitcoin, and just trading it back and forth between two accounts, basically.
Now, what if the fees were very low or even no fees? Would this increase the amount of wash trading?
Well, if the exchange is doing, they don't care. They can have really high fees because the fees are going to themselves anyway. But and it's usually the exchange is doing it because they want to look relevant. They want to go, hey, look, traders, you'll never have a problem here. Look how much volume we've got. Because the problem, what they're saying to traders, first of all, it bumps you up the coin market cap, or these sort of lists. So you go, look, wow, this exchange, I've never heard of them. I might check them out. Or traders go, wow, there's a lot of volume there. So what does that mean? It means that if you have a large position somewhere and you want to let go of that straight away, you're not going to have too much slippage. You're not going to go, you bid at 21,000 for Bitcoin and it drops down to 20,000 because you've sold, one Bitcoin. So that's why.
So coins could not only fake their market cap, but they could also fake their volume.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's a lot of fakes. Dan, Eve, what do you think about this exciting news that half of the Bitcoin trades may be fake?
Well, it's not just half. They gave a specific number, which is very significant, that we've just been talking about. So they came up with the number of 157 exchanges, 51% of the volume is faked. So it's a 51% volume attack.
They get to take over the exchanges now? They have 51%.
Yeah. Arr, climb aboard. It's all this wash trading is just to puff their chests, as Josh said, get them up the ranks, and some of it's really obvious as well. Like they don't make an effort by kind of making the volume vary over 24 hours. So you look at the volume chart, and it's just a flat line. It's like horizontal, where it's just the same number over and over again.
Turn it on.
Yeah, exactly. Bots on and it's just flat, whereas obviously you'd see fluctuations in the volume as you would in price and stuff. But you can do this yourself by checking the order book, and it's really quite easy. So one is to just double check, and you see this on loads of exchanges where the actual trades that are happening you don't seem to see them actually happening or based on the order book that's there. You'll see a trade that's comes up into the history, but there wasn't an order there that matches those specifics before. There's another way is the depth as well. So like that some of the order books, they'll have say 100 Bitcoin on the total buy and across the total buy order book, for example, but the 24-hour volume of 1,000 Bitcoin. So somehow that it's trading 10 times as much as the entire order book. Sell, not buy. So it's a huge difference there. One thing that is quite interesting in all this is that I don't know at which point this happened, but the tether flippening or the tethering, as you could call it, but when the volume of Bitcoin it was superseded by Tether, which is so at the moment the volume of the Tether volume over 24 hours is something like, I think 59 billion, and the volume of Bitcoin is 40 billion. So it's that the actual amount of Tether that's being traded is now significantly more than Bitcoin. And that actually, if you take the volume to market cap, it's Tether's trading at 87% of its volume to the market cap compared to Bitcoin's 10% volume to market cap. But obviously that's because people use Tether for a lot more stuff now, right? Bitcoin used to be the index. Every exchange was Bitcoin, trading Bitcoin against something else. Whereas now a lot of people like to go into Tether rather than Bitcoin when flipping in and out. I think with DEXs, you're less likely to see, I think, logically, wash trading because there's fees that are associated. So it's not just a case of trading an exchange trading with itself. There's a fee structure that goes with it that goes to the people that provide the liquidity. So that may the volume reported from DEXs may be a bit more accurate.
I was just about to say that. DEXs are a lot more accurate because if you look across Polygon, like Uniswap, you can check Uniswap on Polygon, on Ethereum, on Avalanche, and you specifically see Ethereum's got way more volume than Polygon. It's like about 10% of ETH's volume is on Poly. So, and there's a fee, there's a price to trading on Uniswap that goes to a pool. And the pool, if it's a large pool, has many people in it. So you the fee goes to the people that are in that pool. So it's definitely an interesting thing to see that decentralized exchanges are more transparent than centralized exchanges.
Yeah.
Ben Ark, Bitcoin is programmable money. It's supposed to solve all of our problems. How can this still happen? Is it Bitcoin's fault?
Markets, man. I always think back to Adam Smith and his vile maxim of the masters of mankind, all for ourselves and nothing for other people. And then Adam Smith proposed it was the role of government to regulate to stop the masses of mankind screwing over everybody else. Obviously, we don't want government, so it's up to the people, isn't it, to march with their feet, to build better solutions like the decentralized exchanges, more accountable solutions where we can actually figure out how much liquidity there is actually inside these exchanges. But I think wash trading can also encompass external players. So we have in Bitcoin, we used to have the whale cabals who would like shift the price and then get the price to dump and then hoover up all those cheap coins. So that still happens on the more illiquid markets. I'm not sure it happens so much on Bitcoin because it's obviously quite liquid. We also see that, with some of the big dumps which happen to people like Elon Musk, where they dump a lot of coins into the market.
Doing huge dumps.
Huge dumps, big dumps everywhere. And it doesn't really shift the price like it used to. So it is harder. Like your cabal of whales needs to be a little bit bigger. But I'm sure they still exist. I'm sure there's some groups of people with a lot of money who are able to move prices around and move the price of a coin down so they can hoover up the cheap ones. I think less so on Bitcoin. But yeah, it's just up to us to use these decentralized exchanges, use legitimate, honest exchanges like Josh's Voltoro. and to not use these exchange, and also Kraken as well. You know, as we spoke about last week with Jesse Power trying to sort of prove that they have some funds by having some auditing. We've just got to use those services as opposed to using the ones which can fiddle the price, which has a detrimental effect on the whole ecosystem, as we can see, because we've got this bad press. But I do actually think that the academic research which is being done into this topic by, like, was it Forbes who did a research piece? Or it was Forbes, wasn't it? Is also quite very important. Now we're more mainstream, we get more of this academic research from legitimate researchers who aren't just there to FUD, but do actually want to explore the problems of wash trading in sort of the cryptocurrency space. So yeah, it'll only get better.
I mean, real traders see the wash trading, and wash trading exchanges don't last long. They can't last long because they're basically traders come along, like actual traders, and see that the volume isn't there, that there is slippage. So
yeah. But then the problem is if the majority of the liquidity is, you know, the Chinese granny, you know, trading on a phone or whatever it was with the ICO boom, wasn't it? It was the Chinese mothers trying to get some more capital. And I think there's some big players and some legitimate traders who are going to see these patterns, but then there's also a whole bunch of people, vulnerable people, who are just going to get taken advantage of. But then it's that classic thing that, you know, once you've been stung, then hopefully you won't go and play with the bees again.
We're running out of time. Moving on to the exit question, predicting against the magic eight ball, the predictor of predictors, prognosticator of prognosticators. Josh Agala, will the price be higher or lower this time?
Well, it was wrong last year. I mean, last week. It was wrong. We were right. The price is lower, and I think we might be going sideways.
Eve, do you agree we're going sideways?
I was right for the first time in about 10, which makes my record about as good as Jim Cramer's. And so I think I'm actually going to go. I'm still going down. I'm afraid I'm a negative Nancy, as they say. And I think we're still going down a bit.
Ben Ark, the pessimistic panel.
I think that, you know, Elon Musk and Bezos and Saylor on their little Telegram group, I think they're all in agreement now that they pushed the price down. They've hoovered up those cheap coins, and now the price is going to go back up.
There we go. Ben has spoken, and now the magic eight ball. Here we go. Big money, big money. Will the price of Bitcoin be higher this time next week? It says almost impossible to read. Outlook good. Oof, outlook good. Nice. So the eight ball is bullish again.
Eight ball and Ben.
Moving on to issue 3. John McAfee faked his death and is still alive in Texas. Ex-girlfriend claims in new Netflix documentary. A new Netflix documentary perhaps showing more of John McAfee's side, but still a wild ride as the fugitive escapes country after country, fleeing in his yacht, heavily loaded with weapons, greeted at each port where they like to see his weapons. John McAfee in the news again, of course, in the New York Post. So take that with a grain of salt. Also, we'd like to talk about crypto, where the fallen seek a fresh start. The people from WeWork, a failed startup where they wasted millions, perhaps even billions of other people's money, is now back creating a new crypto startup. Maybe we'll have the people from Theranos in crypto soon. Why do we get such wonderful people in crypto? And what about the perhaps continuing adventures of John McAfee? Let's go to Dan E for the crypto wild people.
Well, I think the reason why, starting in reverse, the reason why we get so many fallen angels, if that's probably not the right word, but these fallen people from these crazy startups that failed, is because there's, let's be honest, there's a lot of gullible people in crypto, and that will just throw their money at stuff. And so, you know, they probably don't do their research. They didn't, you know, weren't aware of the fall of WeWork, for example, and they just hear, oh, WeWork, yeah, I remember that. They you know, they were really successful, and they kind of don't know their backstory to it. But with John McAfee
or Theranos, hey, there's a movie about that. That's cool. I've heard of it.
Yeah. Is she in jail right now? The CEO, did she do time?
I don't think they ever put these people in jail. They just make them feel bad and tell them they're not going to give them any more startup money. But we'll see.
But the Fyre Festival guy, he's still in jail, right? Isn't he? Didn't he get like 20 years or something? I don't know.
He's probably starting a new festival. They probably have an NFT.
Yeah. So with John McAfee, though, this is obviously quite interesting. He's I think he's a legend, John McAfee, and it's very sad his passing. I know obviously people didn't like him because he did a shitcoin run in 2017 where he shilled some crazy shitcoins. I don't know. I think I'm a bit dubious about this. Like, it's his ex-girlfriend rather than his wife that he widowed. What if it's like, I don't know. I think 2022 is, and between 2020 and 2022, there's so many crazy things that I could believe anything. For example, now I'm not saying that they did this, but deep fakes are pretty good nowadays. So what if Netflix were like, oh, the John McAfee documentary was really good. Why don't we deep fake his voice and phone his ex-girlfriend and say he's still alive? And then we can interview her. And anything can happen. I don't say that. But, you know, she's like, oh, I don't know if I should say, but 2 weeks ago I got a call for him. Well, if you don't know you should say, usually you'd say that even between friends, but not like, but not on a documentary that's going to be about him. So I don't know. It's all a bit sus, really. I haven't seen the documentary yet, but what did Janice Dyson, his widow, have to say about it? More importantly, as Dyson was a working girl, is that a nickname because of suction power? I don't know. More questions to be answered.
So many questions.
Oh, so many questions. Well, I can speak to a little bit of that, Dan, because I did watch the documentary, and this new Netflix documentary is very different than the old Netflix documentary. The old Netflix documentary called Gringo mainly focused on John McAfee and the alleged incident with his neighbor. If you guys haven't heard, the neighbor had a problem with John McAfee's dogs. They ran wild on the beach. The neighbor is accused of saying, I will poison your dogs. The dogs ended up poisoned. Several of the dogs died. Several of the dogs McAfee himself put out of his misery. Then the neighbor ends up murdered. Some people say that John McAfee claimed he would murder the neighbor, allegedly. So this documentary, very different from that one, a more behind the scenes documentary. At many points, you actually fear for the documentarians' lives. It's like they really got pulled up into it. Like watching the anarchist documentary, this one's almost the same, but they grab the guy by his collar. He jumps on an airplane, and pretty soon they're sneaking into another country. He grabs him by the collar again. They get on a boat. Pretty soon they're sneaking into another country. Just amazing to see the risks that these guys went to get the footage. And also an interesting documentary technically, because it's more like a documentary about the failed documentary. These guys went out there, got a bunch of good footage, didn't know what to do with it. A later crew came along, did another series of interviews, and used that good footage, put it to good use. As for what Dan was saying about the girlfriend versus the wife, the wife seemed very strong. She was yelling at the cameraman to put the camera down, and the cameraman, when the police came in, he'd put it up, he'd keep it on. When the wife yelled at him, he actually turned it off. So there might have been a reason that he called the ex-girlfriend instead of the wife. And as far as the salacious part of this, it's literally the last 30 seconds of the film. The girlfriend says, I got a phone call from John. He's alive in Texas and wanted me to run away with him. So very romantic ending, maybe a second documentary. Maybe there'll be more about this, but the rest of the documentary was just about McAfee, who's a very fascinating figure. I love him or hate him. Josh Shigala, what do you think about the new McAfee documentary and the possibility that he's alive in Texas?
I love it. I think it's great. It's sort of giving that a little bit of that Satoshi mystery, you know, but surrounded by a total shitcoiner. So fascinating. I like John as well. I've met him a couple of times. I was really sad to hear that he passed. The weird thing is, he's like, he lives the lifestyle of a full-on mafia boss without doing anything illegal, apart from maybe dodging some taxes. I don't know. But like, he was just always like, watch out. He's like watching his back. Who are you watching your back from, Johnny? What are you... It was so weird. He liked to live that rebellious lifestyle without actually selling any drugs or selling anything illegal, doing anything. Yeah, anyway. Weird guy, funny story. Definitely one of the characters in Bitcoin. I like that the story sort of lives on. It's kind of like we saw Elvis, you know, he's working at McDonald's or something like that.
It was interesting, Josh, for all the trouble McAfee was in and all the drugs and the alleged murder and so forth. The thing that really pissed the feds off was the $30 million he allegedly took from a shitcoin of the day. It was those tweets where he was like, and it was so transparent. That's why I was always so surprised why people would pay for this kind of promotion, because McAfee clearly loved a new shitcoin every day. Who could have so much room in their heart to love so many shitcoins? But obviously he was being handsomely paid, and that's what led to them tracking him down, is that pissed him off. Ben Ark, your thoughts on John McAfee perhaps being alive and why we just seem to get the best people in crypto?
Yeah, it was death and taxes. The US, I mean, John McAfee publicly refused to pay taxes on all the mad gains he got from all the shit coins. So that's why they, you know, went after him, was they you know, needed to prove that everyone pays their taxes, and that's what they do. So everyone pay your taxes, or else you'll get John McAfee in some prison cell in Spain. When I used to teach IT, computer science, to naughty bastards before doing the Bitcoin stuff, John McAfee was someone I'd whip out in those first few lessons. So if you had some lad, you know, from the estate who doesn't want to engage in his IT lesson, I used to get a picture of John McAfee up with his AKs and with all the marijuana behind him. And I'd be like, look, IT's cool. It's not just for dorks. It's for badasses like me. and it would work too as well. It would work. They would engage afterwards. Go, oh, cool. Okay, I didn't know that. I remember the Vice excerpt actually when John McAfee was on the run. There was a little excerpt they did on Vice Media on YouTube, where he'd just come out of hiding and he was in Guatemala. And it was kind of flaky footage. And then I remember thinking, oh, cool, there's going to be a documentary about this. Because clearly the Rocco guy from Vice was there and he used to film this documentary. And I thought there'd be some good video after that about McAfee. And then it never happened. And I really didn't understand why. And to contradict your point, Thomas, I think the footage was incredibly bad. I mean, the cameraman didn't seem to know what he was doing. And the camera, which he had, he admitted he got given to him by some dude in a bar. And then I actually looked into the reporter as well, the Rocco guy, and I think he left Vice shortly after this. So I think basically what happened was Vice sent these two clowns off to get this great story, and they did a terrible job, probably got a bit messed up on drugs along the way, because they're by proxy with McAfee. I think they just fluffed the film, the documentary. There wasn't enough good footage to make a documentary out of. There was enough footage to make a documentary about trying to make the documentary, which is what we have with this new Netflix documentary, and it's quite interesting to watch. But with McAfee, I mean, he looked really good for his age when he was on the run, and you know, he just and then when he went to the US and was it the Libertarian Party or something he was trying to run as or something. Anyway, he looked very healthy then, but then I think he got back into alcohol and drugs, and the 5 years which passed between him getting back into the US and then going on the run again, you could see that his health had radically declined. And if the dude is still alive, I can't imagine it's for very long, because you can, by the end of this documentary, this Netflix documentary, you can see he wasn't in a particularly good shape. So yeah, I think he's probably dead, and he probably did hang himself, and it was his final last troll on the world. But he's an incredibly complicated and interesting person, just a very good speaker, very good at, I mean, I wish he hadn't have gone down that road, and I wish he'd stuck about and then just focused on Bitcoin and then being a, just somebody who could speak well about technology, because he could always speak well about technology, no matter how, what substances he was on. So for that reason, it was a bit of a shame. And then it was also a shame that he got caught up in all the shitcoinery. But he kind of gets a pass somehow. I don't know why, but John McAfee, I think, has a warm place in a lot of our hearts for just being a wild man.
Well, I do think the cameraman and the interviewer were way over their head. And it almost seemed like they decided to join Hunter S. Thompson's crew. And then about halfway through, they realized, they're like, wait a minute, you know, we're part of Hunter S. Thompson's entourage. We're part of this whole thing. And there was different parts where the camera crew, McAfee was saying things like, keep filming me all the time. And I think he almost thought it was kind of an assassination preventative. As long as the cameras are filming, I can't be shot. Maybe even I can't be arrested, which would be great. That would be an amazing superpower for cameras. And then there's other points, like when they went from, I think, Belize to Guatemala, they get into the other country by boat, and they suddenly realize that no one's going to let you in without an exit stamp, right? Like, you're stamped into Belize, you need to be exit stamped out of Belize before they can stamp you into Guatemala. And it doesn't matter that you were just camera crew following this maniac, like, you're in the same position as the maniac. And I don't think they'd even consider that until they got ashore. Maybe they hadn't used passports very much, that kind of thing.
Is that where they rocked up with all the guns and they got told off by the...
Well, the gun thing, the gun problem, obviously, don't wear your gun in a holster if you're ever going to meet anybody in polite company. Just leave the gun inside. You don't need a holster unless it's a shootout. Then the other problem is the excessive number of guns and that he seemed to have them displayed. I would think maybe if you had a deep hold and you had your hold guns and then you showed them the first two or three, but then... It felt like the first port they went to, they had to throw out five of the guns. And then the next port, they would only have three, which seemed like a more acceptable number of guns, depending on your government rules.
It did seem similar to the anarchist documentary series in a way, in that there was a bunch of people who were like, yeah, I'm going to take loads of drugs and have loads of guns. I'm going to go to South and Central America. I'll do what I want, blah, blah, blah. And then it's like, no, sorry, you're going to get arrested because we don't want you to carry on like that. Thank you very much. Or you're going to get in trouble with the local drug cartels. And it kind of felt a little bit similar in that regard, like living the lifestyle a bit too hard, you know?
Well, taking having a philosophical idea, like I believe in philosophical anarchism, and then going to the real world and trying to practice it and realizing that so much of the real world is just based upon force. If they have the force to do it to you, they can do it to you. If you have the force, you can stop them from doing it to you. And this just kind of guttural sense. But yeah, I agree, Ben. I thought it was a lot like the anarchist documentary. And one of the other interesting points I thought was when McAfee was talking to the camera, and you have to imagine, like you were saying, that the many lives of McAfee, many of us remember installing the antivirus years and years and years. He's on the cutting edge of that. Then he walks away from the company. He keeps claiming all this computer stuff, but it always seems kind of made up. And then at the end, he's saying, like, he also made up this whole drug pirate thing, that he wanted the world to think of John McAfee, wild man, drug pirate, tattoos on his arms, all these things, all the women, all the other stuff we didn't even talk about, unfortunately. But what do you think of that, about McAfee and creating his own image?
I remember him having an interview where someone was asking him if he'd ever lost Bitcoin. And then he said he had, because he didn't put in a change address. And he specified the change address wrong. And then he lost a bunch of Bitcoin. And then I remember thinking, well, that's legitimate. Like, and it's also the sort of issue you would have if you were playing around with the technology and you were kind of doing it in a command line-y type way. You weren't using some wallet which automates that process for you. So I remember thinking, well, that's kind of cool. Like, he has actually got his hands dirty, even though he's this busy guy. He's very rich and, you know, he's got all these sycophants around him. Clearly, at some point, he sat down, command line, tried to do some Bitcoin shit, lost some Bitcoin, not specifying a change address. So that, for me, that legitimized him as, like, still a techie, you know, still someone who's interested in technology. So that was kind of my anecdotal evidence on that.
Well, and I think the way he started McAfee Antivirus is he might have been just collecting viruses. And he's like, oh, these are cool. Like, I want to study them. I want to see what they do.
He was the first person to issue a patch for a virus and then make it, like, publicly available. That's how it started. And then he realized that he could probably make some money by selling the solution.
It was a genius plan. Let's move on to the exit question. Is John McAfee alive? Josh Shigala, yes or no? Still muted.
No.
Dan Eve, yes or no?
Yeah, he's chilling on an island with Tupac and Elvis.
Very sarcastic, yes. Ben Ark, you can save the day for the girlfriend. She received a phone call. Is John McAfee alive?
There's a little John McAfee in all of us.
Oh, the romantic answer. I'm going to agree with the panel. Unfortunately, I think that John McAfee is dead and the world is less interesting without him, just like John Dillinger killed for trying to go to a movie. Speaking of movies, did you know the World Crypto Network has its own webpage at worldcryptonetwork.com? You can watch the board on the side as Thomas Hunt leads the leaderboard, followed by Tone Vaze, Dan Eve, Jimmy Song, and Joshua Shigala picking up the rear. What will happen next? We've also got a podcast on Apple iTunes and other places. You could give us a rating. It would be our first rating in years. Our old ratings are very old. You could give us a new rating on Apple iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. We've also been keeping it up to date. They say that we are updated weekly now, so they believe in us again. Moving on to issue 4, crypto ATM Bitcoin Depot to go public with an $885 million SPAC deal. At first, I was like, why do I care about this? Then I read it again. $885 million. They're going to put Bitcoin ATMs all over the United States and 9 Canadian provinces where they could convert cash into Bitcoin, Ethereum, or Litecoin, maybe even Dogecoin. Josh Agala, $885 million for crypto ATMs.
It's a pretty epic, bold move, I'll tell you what. One thing that's always confused me is why don't they just use old, like, why don't banks just turn on crypto? I don't know. They've got the screen, they've got the cash part, they've got the software, like, what? But anyway, yeah, it's cool. Let's do it.
That's what exactly what I was thinking, and I can't believe there's such a large investment in what I would worry about is an industry, like you say, could be wiped out with a single upgrade to their ATM machines. A single software update could wipe out your entire almost $1 billion bet.
Yeah.
Dan Eve, Bitcoin ATMs worth the investment? It's also going to be on the stock market. You could buy this company on the NASDAQ.
What? I think it sounds pretty ninja. Anything to get Bitcoin more in front of people's faces is a good thing. With existing banks though, right? Most ATMs only spit out cash, right? So the downside to that would be it would only be for people selling Bitcoin, in theory, right? They would send the Bitcoin to the ATM.
A lot of ATMs these days do have photo readers and could read like checks or could read dollar bills. So if you put 20s in, it is possible you could buy Bitcoin at those ATMs. It would be ATM by ATM service, though.
They're mainly spit out in the UK. I mean, you do get deposit ones, right? They're actually in the bank, but the ones that you find on the wall and like in shops and stuff, they're spit out only.
Well, in many ways, that makes it worse. That means that what I think of as the inexpensive ATMs, the ones at gas stations, those would be the one way. But if, say, Bank of America decides they take Bitcoin tomorrow, they turn on all the ATMs they own, and they even have a staff of people to help you if you're really confused.
That would be good. The only downside is that I think they're probably concerned a traditional bank's concerned about like the confusion over Bitcoin, like as in they'd have to train up all their staff, right? Whereas like, you know, the people who are buying crypto specifically, or buying a crypto machine, they're kind of almost geared up for the fact that they're going to have to tell people how it works or whatever. There's always stories about people that go into the ones that are in a shop, for example, and they're like trying to put their life savings in there because they've read it on the internet that if they don't go and deposit Bitcoin to this address, then the tax man will get them, even though it's a crazy made up phishing type story. I think that's probably
the tax man wants like Spotify gift cards.
Yeah. What? Is that what I've heard stories about? That shit, man.
It's terrible. It's really bad. But actually, one thing that banks might be able to use this for by turning these things on is actually they could save a lot of money by turning this on, because it's amazing how much they spend on Brinks armored cars refilling these things, right? What they could do is they could say, hey, the cash pile's low on this machine, so they could make Bitcoin slightly cheaper on there, the spread slightly less. So people will go and actually put money into those machines, and they could publicly say, hey, this machine here is cheaper right now than this one, and sort of have the users, the humans, actually filling machines where it's needed. But
you know what could really save them money is if they adopted the entire casino model, because the casinos don't have cash machines anymore. You put your cash in and you get a little voucher that says, hey, $15 if you scan it somewhere. So the banks could just give out those vouchers. They don't even have to give out cash anymore. This is a great deal.
Cash is a voucher.
Oh, spoiler alert.
I owe you.
Ben Ark, what do you think about the Bitcoin ATMs deal? Is it a good deal, a bad deal?
I mean, like we were saying there with ATMs, like in the UK, we've got some, suddenly all the ATM operators got hit with this like pretty archaic regulation. So I kind of have a feeling that maybe some of the CFTC Bitcoin being registered as a commodity in the US means that these ATMs are going to become, you know, more legitimate. I'm just buying some gold, you know, like it's maybe that's part of the investment and why, because now we have in the US, you have like, you will have clearer regulations for the whole country as opposed to just state regulations, which maybe have impacted the decision to roll out all these ATMs. I think with an ATM, I mean, obviously if you're buying Bitcoin, the easiest way would be you put your card in and then you just say, I want to buy some Bitcoin. And then it just shows you, prints out a QR code or whatever. So you don't necessarily have to put cash in. So you could just bypass the cash bit. And actually with the cash, I mean, I have here, like I got myself a couple of bill acceptors, of course. Everyone should have a few at least.
Easy
and these are by, I'm going to do some shilling now, they're by a very good company in the UK called Innovative Technologies. And the notes go in it. It does polymer notes, so a horrible British plastic notes, actually, will recognize these. Brilliant little bit of engineering. It's fantastic. But you get an additional module which goes on the bottom of it, which is a hopper. So the cash goes in, it gets sorted. And then if you want, you can then have the cash come out as well. It's fairly easy to do. And I imagine that most ATMs have these hoppers built into them because they're just going to have the cash fall into a bucket. So probably you can also get the cash to spit out of these bill acceptors if you wanted to, and then use them as a Bitcoin ATM for in and out, putting cash in, taking cash out, whatever, and also use it for your card as well. So yeah, Starling's a great bank. They do crypto stuff. Maybe they'll roll out a couple of ATMs in the US. But I really can't help thinking that this ATM, if you're going to invest that much money into infrastructure, into the Bitcoin space, then something like the CFTC stuff with the Bitcoin is going to be very relevant to you, I think. So I kind of thinking it's somehow related to that.
Well, since Ben pulled out that, I'm going to pull out some gadgets. I've got this Etch-a-Sketch here. It allows you to draw. Ooh, yeah. and you can just wipe it off like that and redraw, you know. So just saying.
That's an incredible, incredible technology. I definitely keep that away from the banks.
Yeah.
And we're moving on to our final issue, bonus issue tonight. These Bored Apes will melt in your mouth. M&M's releases NFT-inspired candy. A licensing deal between Mars and music label UMG means that Bored Ape NFT images are now printed on M&M chocolate candies. NFTs continue to be the greatest advertising resource for Bitcoin that all Bitcoiners hate. Josh Shigala, why do the Bitcoiners continue to hate NFTs when they make article after article spreading the word about non-fungible tokens, which if you even try to learn what that means, you become a Bitcoiner and you become infinitely more geeky.
Yeah, actually, I was interested why it was UMG. Did the music label buy Bored Ape Yacht Club?
I believe they have. They've bought Bored Ape Yacht Club, and Bored Ape Yacht Club has purchased CryptoPunks, And now it's like a giant media conglomerate. I'm not sure if they bought them or if they just did a licensing deal, but they are trying to put apes and punks into animated TV shows, movies, marketing, everything.
Everything. I mean, it's amazing. And actually, what I'd love to see Mars do is put a different crypto logo on each Mars. That'd be cool.
Bitcoin. I do think the orange M&Ms would be perfect for Bitcoin. Yeah. Dan, Eve, what do you think about the Bored Ape M&M Club?
They didn't. So UMG didn't buy the company, did they? Or did they just buy four of them and then use those in their imagery? Because I understood it as they literally bought.
It does look like they have four Bored Apes.
Yeah, rather than buying the whole, like...
Yeah, you know, it doesn't look like they have the whole company, but...
I see, even geniuser, right? You buy a couple of... This was my idea back with CryptoKitties. You buy one CryptoKitty, make a cartoon about that one. Yeah. It becomes famous, and then that CryptoKitty is worth a whole lot more.
It looks like this has to do with a band that UMG is creating out of Bored Apes. So I think it's the Bored Ape band that is now featured on the M&Ms.
The zombie one has to be the drummer, surely.
It's a cool idea though, isn't it? You know, that I can see there's just so many different use cases for NFTs, and interesting to see how existing companies aren't just making their own NFTs, but they're leveraging other NFTs that they're buying and leveraging the rights of those and then using them. Maybe the NFTs have the general market's dropped a lot in terms of volume and, you know, average prices and all that, but they're definitely here to stay. Like, that's one thing that's for sure. There's so many use cases that we haven't even thought of yet. And I'm not sure about the gaming industry, but, you know, surely one of the biggest markets is this, you know, the buyables in games. Like, there's the traditional games, right? Like something like Call of Duty suddenly going down the NFT route, or something huge like that. I can definitely see that coming for sure. But I don't know. I think ultimately, love it or hate it, NFTs they're definitely here to stay, and they've got so many cool different utilities. So it'd be interesting to see if is it, what's the Satoshi one on? What's the Bitcoin version of NFTs? The one that's on Liquid.
Rare Toshi.
Yeah, be interesting to see if there's much adoption for Rare Toshis and NFTs on Bitcoin. But they're certainly doing the rounds in terms of, I don't know, they've got, you know, influencers and music stars and singers and actors. You know, they're all buying them, so they're definitely making the rounds. That's for sure.
Ben Ark, first it's a collectible, now it's a candy.
Yeah, it's all the all the cool prick front end people who are like, yeah, we should do NFTs. And there's all these designers these designers in these big companies who are saying to their bosses in those fancy board meetings with the big white tables, and they're like, yeah, NFTs, we should do the NFTs. And then they're all NFTing. Whereas you don't get many of them in Bitcoin, because we got rid of them when they all went to Ethereum. So when they come back to Bitcoin, maybe they'll build NFTs on Bitcoin. But for now, we don't have to worry about it. But this idea that they're in a band, I mean, that's clearly like a Gorillaz ripoff. I'm sure Damon Albarn's got some, you know, grounds to sue on that front. On Bitcoin gaming companies, Zebedee is the greatest Bitcoin gaming company in the world. Currently, they're doing incredible work. Check out Zebedee if you don't know what Zebedee are. They're doing some real innovative stuff. They haven't really touched the NFT thing yet. They're more focusing on in-game, you know, being able to use Lightning Network in a game where you pay to play, win some sats, that sort of stuff, which is why I like them. Because quite often with this idea of using NFTs in games, they try and build a game around the NFT, whereas I think in reality, something like Rockstar will just implement some non-fungible qualities to the items in Grand Theft Auto, and you'll be able to get some cool gun and be assured that there's only 1,000 of them, and then the game isn't going to print more of them. So I don't think it's going to come from some Bitcoin company or some crypto company trying to make some game, and including NFTs. I think it's going to be some big game company which will then use NFTs, and that'll be super cool, like World of Warcraft or Game of, you know, that'll be very good. But yeah, check out Zebedee. They're a great company. NFTs.
We're running out of time. Josh Shigala, are you ready with a prediction or a story of the week? Go ahead.
I still call them colored coins, I'll tell you. Yeah.
That's out of fashion these days.
It's out of fashion. Politically incorrect, yeah.
That was a terrible term, wasn't it, when they called them colored coins? It really was a terrible term.
Why? I thought it was great because it really, I never thought of it like that, like what you said.
Honestly, I didn't until you said it for some reason.
That's the first time when you said that I've ever even thought of it like that. I liked it because it was like you color one coin and you could follow it through the network. And that's what always was in my mind. Anyway, is what it is. But so if you go, we have these community calls every week, and during these community calls, we give away these proof of attendance NFTs, and they're absolutely amazing. I'll quickly share the screen here, see if I can bring up the old. Let's see, share screen. Here we go. So can you see that? I don't know. Oops. Can you see the rings? I don't know. Oh, yeah. So yeah, so these we give out when you listen to the show and you just retweet our tweet with the number that you want and your Polygon address, and we'll send one to you. So make sure join the Telegram or just follow me at Jay Shigala. I'll put it in the chat here in a minute, and we'll tell you when the next community call's on, because these are absolutely sensational, and they have some reason for being around as well. So check out thestandard.io. Go to that and you'll see the Telegram there, or I'll post it in the chat in a minute. But people are loving that, and you know, it's not really part of the standard protocol. It's just a fun thing for the community. But it really showed me the power of an image, an art, and allowing people to collect it. But also, NFTs aren't just the image. They can be used for a key to unlock stuff. And if you get clever with them, you can also build a network of keys. And there's all sorts of interesting things you can do with NFTs. Also, when we're building out the standard, you know, what the standard is the ability to lock up assets and then mint a stablecoin from those assets. And sometimes you have these debts to yourself and maybe you can't pay off that debt anymore and you've got all these assets locked up. So what we're looking at is the ability to sell that as an NFT, that debt, collateralized debt position as an NFT to someone else, and they would buy it, pay off the debt, and unlock the assets inside. So it would be a great way to be able to at least recover some money if you couldn't pay off the debt that you took out on yourself. So check out thestandard.io. That's what we're working on really hard, and our community's growing every day. These rings have really helped push stuff out. There's 260 of them to give out. And we're going to release more next Thursday. We do a show every Thursday on Twitter Spaces. So be sure to join us for that.
Well, very cool. I've always said that NFTs should be used for marketing. And it's good to see Josh doing that, as well as a proof of participation, community building, all of these things. And maybe even someday, valuable. Who knows? It's that signature that you own, and it's a collectible, and it's worth as much as someone will pay you for it. Dan, Eve, prediction or story of the week? Go ahead.
Okay, I'm gonna do both. So prediction is that a gaming company, maybe not this week, you know. So, but a gaming company will bring out NFTs, like an existing one that's big, because it stands to reason why they would. If M&M's are doing it, right, Mars are doing it, then the perfect excuse for a girl, you know, reason would be for a game company to do it, and building on the rings. So the Midjourney is one of these incredible like image generators I've been fiddling around with, and it is amazing. Like I've been trying to do really abstract stuff, like the God particle and like the standard model, and just seeing what sort of random stuff that it comes up with. But yeah, it's just you can just play around with it eternally. It's absolutely amazing. Just the level that AI's come is just incredible. And even just from the different beta versions, so you can change the different parameters and you know put something you want in, and then try the beta one and beta two and different versions of it. And it's just mind blowing. It's amazing some of the stuff that it comes out with.
Yeah, apparently so TikTok just brought theirs out. Their image text to image model as well. So it's just going. There's about 30 of them now, different companies releasing there. So there's a huge competition in the space to get this. One group that I think is interesting that hasn't released one is Adobe. I think that should be in Photoshop. It would be really awesome to have that embedded in Photoshop because it just makes so much sense.
Well, and what's so great about it, like Dan been saying, I've been messing with Midjourney as well. Not only can it create the creative parts for you, like I've been making NFTs, it'll also make a background header image for you. It'll help you make a great thumbnail. It'll make you a logo for your company. Maybe something you hadn't even thought of, like putting in the words for your company, like colored coins. Who knows what's going to come out the other side? And I agree with Dan. It's almost, I already feel like it's like my AI friend. Like let's go make some art together with my AI friend and see what comes out. And then I kind of try to publish the best ones, and combining that with the NFT, I think it's kind of fun. Like you're making little collectibles, and then if people want to collect them, that's fine too.
Yeah, it's a great idea to package it into graphic software like Adobe. So if you just want a little bit of inspiration, you could just click it and it'll just go, oh, have you thought about doing this? And create something which you would never be able to create in a million years. It'd be a really good idea to have that sort of stuff in there, in those graphic design projects. And I'm graphic designers, and my little rant about NFTs and the cool bricks. Obviously, my panelist is full of NFT innovators who I very much respect and hold in the highest regard. I'm not categorizing you in the same category of the M&M's designers who pitched the NFT M&M's.
Great is it's not just M&M's, it's also Eminem. M&M's working on a project with Snoop Dogg. They're going to put music into NFTs, and Snoop Dogg's gone so far as he even pulled all of his music off of Apple Music and Spotify, and he's going to make people buy these NFT versions. He owns sick. Death Row Records now.
And it is a lot of, like you say, you I mean, I think I was listening to it's almost admitted publicly, but I was listening to a Joe Rogan podcast, and in there one of them asked, what is an NFT? And you're right, as soon as you research that stuff, you're like, well, why does it need to be non-fungible? And then they all of a sudden they're dorks, and they join the legion of dorks, which is good. I really like your NFTs, Josh, as well. I can't help imagining that you've got one ring to rule them all in the darkness behind them. I hope.
Well, we're running out of time. Ben Ark, do you have a prediction or a story of the week? Go ahead.
Yeah, my Lee and Gene, who are developers, a couple of people contributors to LMBits, they've made a Bolt card extension, which is almost ready. Like, we're going to release it pretty soon. And then that will allow you to create those Lightning payment cards people have been getting excited about on Twitter, where you can create a unique LNURL withdraw, so like a withdraw faucet with every tap. That's very exciting. I was having a little review of that today, and adding in some functionality as well, so you can add in like maximum spend and then maximum daily spend, so you can simulate, you know, legacy tap and pay cards, and it works really well as well. There's a video on Bitcoin Reddit if you want to go have a look at it, and they do a race between a standard legacy bank card and then a Bolt card, and the Bolt card's like wins. So it's pretty cool.
Nice to see Bitcoin racing against banks now.
Fine. Yeah, we're out competing them. It's crazy, isn't it? Like, for a while we had these different properties like sensitive, resistant, blah blah blah, and now with the Lightning stuff we can now actually out compete them, transaction throughput and speed of transactions and whatever else.
So good, so epic. Wait until Michael Saylor hears about this.
It's very popular on Twitter to criticize the Ethereum merge, but I, for one, believe that it will work. And if it doesn't work, what's even better is that they'll fix it. Ethereum is like they're building a huge Jenga stack up into space, and they have all these scientific advisors flying around the stack trying to keep it working. And it drives everyone insane because they say the stack could fall over at any time if it wasn't for all the scientific advisors. Developers, 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 developers. Ethereum will survive. We're out of time. Until next time, bye-bye. Bye-bye.